Okay, good morning. This is Bio 241, and it's Thursday, and it is February 19th. And we're in the middle of Chapter 5, which is cellular respiration. Does anybody have any questions on cellular respiration? No questions on cellular respiration? All right, here's the sign-in sheet. Please sign the sign-in sheet. And pass it around. Okay, so last time we were looking at anaerobic respiration and glycolysis. So if you want to think of glycolysis, how should you, what's an easy way to think of glycolysis? Yeah, it's a breakdown of glucose. And how are you going to break it down? Into how many pieces? In just the two pieces. What are those two pieces called? Yeah, pyruvic acid. All right. And what kind of reaction is that? Is that an endothermic or an exothermic reaction? All right, so glucose, maybe I should write this on the board. Glucose going to pyruvate. All right, and on what side of the equation should I put energy as a product or a reactant? It's a product, right? So here is energy over here, and if energy is on the right-hand side of the equation, you would call that what kind of thermodynamic reaction? It is a exothermic, right? Exothermic, because there's leftover energy, right? There's more energy in the reactants than the products. And what does your body do with that energy? Yeah, what does it do with that energy? Yeah, it makes ATP with it, right? So with that energy, your body can take ADP plus inorganic phosphate, right? Plus energy over here that it gets from, for instance, this process, glycolysis, to go in the reverse direction to make ATP. And what kind of reaction is that? That's an endothermic reaction, right? That's endothermic. And remember in that one slide it said that most exothermic reactions in the body are used to generate ATP. All right, so glycolysis is coupled to the production of ATP. So the exothermic reactions of glycolysis are used to drive those endothermic reactions to make ATP. All right, the other things that we learned last time are the names of a number of pathways. Right, but before we start getting into some of the pathways involving glucose specifically, let's just go over the four main kinds of metabolic pathways that I want you to know. Right, the first one is glucose going to pyruvate. That happens in the cytosol. Does that require oxygen? No, absolutely not. The second one is under aerobic conditions, pyruvic acid enters the mitochondria and it gets converted into a or it's added to the Krebs cycle. We call that a preparatory reaction, right? So that's the second one right here. Make sure in your notes you got a number two, preparatory reaction. The third metabolic pathway is the Krebs cycle, and the fourth metabolic pathway is the electron transport chain. Okay. All right, so that's some of the building blocks of respiration that you have to become aware of. All right, now remember that glucose can have a number of different fates inside the body. Glucose can be broken down into pyruvic acid via, what's the name of that pathway again, metabolic pathway? That's glycolysis. All right, glycolysis can run in the reverse direction, so pyruvate can be converted back into glucose. What do we call that? That's gluconeogenesis. And glucose can be used by the liver to make glycogen. What's that called? Glycogenesis. And then when you're in a fasted state, the liver can break glycogen down and put glucose in the blood. What's that called? Glycogenolysis, right? So glycogenolysis and glycolysis are kind of similar, except glycolysis breaks down glucose and glycogenolysis breaks down glycogen. Now, all those words sound really similar, all right, but they're spelled differently, and you pronounce them differently, and they have drastic different meanings in terms of your biochemistry. So make sure you know those four terms and which way those metabolic pathways are going. Okay. All right, so that's kind of a review of what we looked at last time. Glycolysis. All right, but I tell you what, let's review glycolysis just a little bit more. All right, so we start with glucose. We end up with two pyruvates. What's the, in terms of energy production, what does glycolysis provide for us in terms of high energy intermediates? Okay. So I see it produces 1, 2, 3, 4 ATP, but don't forget what happened before that. Yeah, you have to subtract 2 out because that energy of 2 ATPs are necessary to get glycolysis going. So the net gain is 2 ATP. And what other high energy intermediate is produced? Yeah, 2 NADHs, right? And you should know that that's an oxidation reduction reaction, and NADH is what form of NAD? is it the oxidized form or the reduced form? It's the reduced form because 2 electrons were donated to NAD plus to make it NADH. All right, so glycolysis produces 2 ATP. I want to make a little table as we're going over here. And also 2 NADHs. I'll see if I can make sense out of this as we progress through the lecture. Okay. And one of the last things we were looking at last time is this lactate dehydrogenase reaction. All right, what's the purpose of this reaction right here, and when does it take place? Actually, as a matter of fact, let's tell me, when does it take place? Under what kind of conditions? Under anaerobic conditions. And so what's the function of this particular pathway? What does it do for us? Okay, looks like it's using up an important molecule. It's using up pyruvic acid. Now, is that a good thing or a bad thing under anaerobic conditions? That's really a good thing, because if pyruvic acid were to build up, what would happen? It would stop glycolysis. As a matter of fact, it would force glycolysis in the reverse direction because of Le Chatelier's principle. And when glycolysis stops working, then it wouldn't produce any ATP whatsoever, right? And that would contribute to the cell's demise very rapidly because ATP wasn't being produced. All right, what else happens besides the removal of pyruvic acid from the cell? What else is another important thing? Yeah, it gets rid of NADH, because that's going to force the reverse of glycolysis, which is going to stop ATP production. But another way of looking at it, when lactic acid is formed, NADH is converted into NAD+. What do we call that when NADH gets converted back to NAD+? Yeah, it becomes oxidized. All right, and so this lactate dehydrogenase pathway regenerates NAD, and that's an important intermediate right here in order for glycolysis to go in the forward direction. Right, so the lactate dehydrogenase reaction right here, or pathway, allows glycolysis to operate under anaerobic conditions. Okay, if this pathway was not operating, then glycolysis couldn't happen under anaerobic conditions. All right, so let's just write down maybe in a little square right here. Under anaerobic conditions, what does glycolysis produce for us? Right? Yeah, it produces lactic acid. I'm not so concerned about lactic acid at the moment, but in terms of these high energy molecules, it's only going to produce, 2 ATP, because these NADHs get used up under anaerobic conditions. Okay? Anybody got any questions on that? That's what we talked about last time. All right, and then, of course, we reviewed all that. All right, well, now let's focus our attention back on aerobic respiration. Oh, let's go back to the very first slide again. Where is aerobic respiration? That's when all the carbon atoms in glucose go through glycolysis, the preparatory reaction, Krebs cycle, electron transport, and end up in CO2. The cell also ends up producing water as a result of that. Okay, so all of these reactions that you see on this figure right here, do you view these as endothermic reactions or exothermic, or a mixture of endothermic and exothermic reactions? These are all exothermic reactions. They're going to be releasing energy. All right, and guess what your cell does with that energy through all these different processes? It makes ATP, right? Okay. All right, so aerobic respiration. Here is the preparatory reaction. You probably would recognize this as pyruvic acid. And you see this functional group right here. What's that functional group? That's a carboxyl group. It's very easy to decarboxylate an organic compound. And here is a coenzyme. And remember, a coenzyme is going to carry an organic molecule around inside the body someplace and donate it to another set of chemical reactions. This is coenzyme A. And when pyruvic acid becomes decarboxylated, that produces a CO2. And this two-carbon fragment right here joins coenzyme A and becomes acetyl coenzyme A. All right, so now where does this process take place? Where does this process take place? And under what kind of conditions can it take place? Yeah, it can happen under aerobic conditions in the mitochondria, right? So pyruvic acid has to enter the mitochondria, and it cannot even enter the mitochondria under anaerobic conditions. All right, so in this process, this is not only is it a decarboxylation reaction, but it is also an oxidation reduction reaction. Because what gets reduced? NAD plus gets reduced to NADH, and NADH, don't forget, is carrying what around? Yeah, two high-energy electrons that can be used to do some work later on. Okay, now these NADHs are inherently different than the NADHs made by glycolysis. Why is that? Who can think of why the NADHs that are made by the preparatory reaction are different than the NADHs made by glycolysis? What's the difference? Okay, one is made by aerobic metabolism and the other is by anaerobic. This is very true. And the question that I really want you to answer is, where does anaerobic respiration take place? Cytosol, where does aerobic respiration take place? In the mitochondria, right? So the difference of these two different NADHs is that one is made in the cytosol and the other is made inside the mitochondria. And that makes a little bit of difference as to how much energy we can get from those electrons. All right, so just kind of put that in the back of your mind for right now. Okay, that's the prep reaction. Now, this two-carbon fragment right here is going to end up in the Krebs cycle. So don't forget, a coenzyme is just going to shuttle something from one set of reactions to another, and so here is the prep reaction. You can see CO2 being produced. And now, how many NADHs are produced by the preparatory reaction for every glucose molecule? There are two, right? Because we've broken glucose down into two. So don't forget, there really should be like a little two right here. All right, so that acetyl group gets donated to oxaloacetic acid, which is a four-carbon molecule. So what is produced is a six-carbon molecule, which we call citric acid. You don't have to name any of these intermediates. The thing that you should really focus on is just the number of carbon atoms in these in this pathway right here. Like an acetyl group has how many carbon atoms? It's got two. All right? It doesn't have three because of that decarboxylation step in the preparatory reaction. So only two carbons are added to the Krebs cycle. And as the Krebs cycle interconverts a number of intermediates, look what happens. There are two other decarboxylation reactions. All right, so now what happens to all the carbons that started with glucose? What has it been turned into? It's been turned into CO2 in the prep reaction and has been turned into two more CO2s in the Krebs cycle. But don't forget, for every glucose, this Krebs cycle actually turns around twice, right? Because for every glucose, we produce two acetyl coenzyme A's. All right, so all the carbons that are added to the Krebs cycle get used up and eventually are excreted from our body as CO2. All right, and as the Krebs cycle is turning, as these intermediates are switching places, there are oxidation reduction reactions. As well as these decarboxylations, and you see the arrows on the Krebs cycle. This is the way that the Krebs cycle always works. It doesn't really go in the reverse direction. So when it's moving in this clockwise fashion, is it exothermic or endothermic? It's exothermic. And what is, through evolution, what has evolved as a result of this big exothermic reaction? The production of ATP, right? Okay. So the Krebs cycle produces one guanosine triphosphate. It has high energy phosphate bonds in it, just like ATP does, but the base is just a little bit different. It has a guanine instead of an adenine. But the energy in GTP is very similar to the energy in ATP. So that one GTP can be used to phosphorylate adenosine diphosphate. And so whenever you see this GTP right here, you should think of it as actually producing an ATP. Also through the Krebs cycle, there are three enzymatic reactions that produce an NADH, and there is one enzymatic reaction that produces an FADH2. So don't forget, NADH is what form of NAD? It is the reduced form, and FAD is the reduced form of FAD. So both FADH2 and NADH are carrying two high energy electrons. And these are both coenzymes, because they're going to donate those electrons to something we call the electron transport chain, which we're going to get to in just a little bit. All right, so here is the whole Krebs cycle. That shows all of the different reactions, and probably in your book, these numbers here just represent the name of different enzymes that catalyze these reactions. And as as acetyl CoA comes in and donates two carbons to oxaloacetic acid, it produces citric acid, and through some rearrangements and some other reactions, we see it can produce what? It produces one NAD, produces two NADHs, produces three NADHs for every turn of the Krebs cycle. All right, and it releases two carbon dioxides here and here. All right, so don't be fooled by this arrow is kind of going the opposite way, but the Krebs cycle is definitely producing NADHs. All right, so do you see three of them right here? In another intermediate step, we can see that when alpha-ketoglutaric acid gets converted to succinic acid, then there's enough energy in this reaction. This is enough of a exothermic reaction to actually phosphorylate this guanosine diphosphate and produce a GTP. Right, and that is sufficient to do what? To produce an ATP as a result of that. Okay, the next enzymatic reaction produces the reduced FAD or FADH2. All right, so what I want you to appreciate is where is this taking place? That's in the mitochondria. Under what kind of conditions? It's got to be aerobic conditions, can't happen under anaerobic conditions. And for every acetyl group that enters the Krebs cycle, what are the high energy intermediates that are produced? You see, 1, 2, 3 NADHs, one ATP, and one FADH2. So let me see if I can write this down on the board. Preparatory reaction. What did the preparatory reaction give us? Okay, and I'm going to kind of put like a dotted line right here. What does that dotted line represent? Mitochondria, right? That's a mitochondria. So the preparatory reaction produces what? NADH, but how many of them for every glucose? Okay, you know what? I think of two. It only produces one, but that's per acetyl group, and there are two acetyl groups. So I'm going to put two NADHs right here. Krebs cycle. That happens in the mitochondria under aerobic conditions. Yeah.
So the preparatory reaction
the preparatory reaction is when pyruvic acid gets converted to acetyl-CoA. Okay, it's just that step right there. And you have a slide of just that one reaction. So it's not really a metabolic pathway, it's just a single chemical reaction. And it produces NADH as well. Okay, so Krebs cycle, what do we get? We get three NADHs, we get one, FADH2, and what else do we get out of the deal? One ATP as a result of that. All right, so far I think we're looking pretty good. We'll see if we can reconstruct all of this. Well, it depends on how the question is asked, all right, but you should probably think of ATP that's being produced. ATP, yeah. It's just that in this reaction right here, the high energy intermediate that is most directly produced is GTP, but it gets converted to ATP secondarily very rapidly. Okay. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Yep, because that pyruvate has to enter the mitochondria for that enzyme to work. Can't work in the cytosol. All right, so what else about the Krebs cycle? What else is happening in the Krebs cycle? Well, you know it's what? In the mitochondria, it requires oxygen, produces three NADHs, one FADH2, one ATP. What else does it produce?
Water.
It produces CO2. It produces CO2. And what do we do with that CO2? We have to breathe it out of our body because it produces carbonic acid, which is very acidic, and that would wreck our acid-base balance if we didn't excrete CO2 from our bodies. Okay. I'm not going to say much about the use of water with the Krebs cycle, okay, but I will make a point out of water being important in the electron transport chain. Okay. All right, because I just want you to focus on NADHs, FADHs, and ATP. Yeah. That's right. So this happens twice, yes, for every glucose molecule. Okay, so this right here, right, we're going to have to multiply by 2. Preparatory reaction. Ah, okay, so what am I using here? I'm using for every glucose in this column. 2, 2, 2, 2, 2. All right, so should I do that conversion right now? That might make it a little bit more obvious. All right, so the preparatory reaction for one acetyl-CoA, it produces one NADH, but there are two for every glucose. All right, so for every glucose, the Krebs cycle produces 6, all right, and produces two ATP, okay? Yeah, for every glucose. That's probably good to mention that now. Okay, electron transport chain. All right, so here is an illustration of the electron transport chain, and what's being transported in the ETC? Electrons, right? And what kind of molecule do you know about that has electrons to donate to ETC? Yeah, NADH and FADH2 can donate electrons, and what's the energy state of those electrons in NADH and FADH2? They're high, right? So they're going to want to flow from high energy to low energy via this set of exothermic reactions. These electrons are just going to move from one molecule to another. So for instance, NADH can donate 2 electrons to a compound we're just going to call FMN. This is not an exam figure, all right? But what kind of reaction is this right here? Oxidation reduction reaction, all right? So then FMN gets converted into FMNH2, it can donate those 2 electrons to coenzyme Q. All right, and coenzyme Q then goes from an oxidized state to a reduced state. Coenzyme Q can donate electrons to cytochrome B, and B can donate them to C1. C1 can donate them to cytochrome C, and then to cytochrome A. So these cytochromes right here are special kinds of organic molecules that can undergo oxidation-reduction reactions, or another way of thinking of it, right? It kind of acts like a wire where these electrons can flow through, and in so doing, it can be coupled to ATP synthesis. And we're going to look and see how that happens in the next couple of slides. All right, so in order for these electrons to move through the electron transport chain, something has to absorb them at the end of the electron transport chain. And the molecule that can accept electrons, right, is oxygen. So If oxygen is not present, none of these electrons will flow through any of these cytochrome molecules. Right? They will stop. Right? And one way to think of that is because of Le Chatelier's principle. If cytochrome C1 is completely in the reduced state, okay, then these electrons can't get past that one step. As a matter of fact, they might have a tendency even to flow in the reverse direction. So the electron transport chain has to use up those electrons, and the molecule that uses up those electrons to make sure that ETC works in this direction is oxygen. All right? And when oxygen is reduced, along with some protons from this reaction right here, that produces water. All right? So that's why electron transport can only operate under aerobic conditions. Okay, and that explains why also why the Krebs cycle can only work under aerobic conditions, because if ETC is not operating, what happens to NADH? Yeah, it just stays in the reduced form, it builds up inside the mitochondria, and it stops the Krebs cycle. And also it's going to stop the preparatory reaction. All right, so the electron transport chain is a linked series of proteins on the Christi membranes, that's the inner membrane of the mitochondria, that can transmit these electrons from one molecule to another. All right, and we call those typically cytochromes. All right, so through electron transport, how many ATPs do you see are produced for every NADH right here? Okay, 3. So that is the theoretical maximum for every NADH in terms of the ATPs that can be produced. And that's what I want you to know in this class. All right, your book goes into a lot of discussion about how many ATP can really be produced under real world conditions by every NADH. All right, but I'm not going to focus on that. I want you to know that the answer is 3. Okay. All right, and we can see that FADH2 donates electrons to the electron transport chain, but is it at the same energy level as NADH? It is at what? A lower energy level, and so it's going to miss this first step right here in ATP synthesis. So for every 2 electrons that are donated by FADH2, how many ATP are produced? You can only see 2, here and here. And again, that's a theoretical maximum. And people will be discussing probably for the next 100 years under what conditions is that true, under what kinds of tissues, or is that true or false. All right, but in this class, if I ask you how many ATP can be produced in the mitochondria by FADH2, you're going to say, okay, 2. But under real world conditions, all right, you should probably just have in the back of your mind that I might not reach that theoretical maximum. All right, but for right now, just say 2 for FADH2 and 3 for NADH. Okay, but nonetheless, all of those electrons end up where? In this water molecule right here. All right, so the final molecule that is produced by the electron transport chain is actually water. So again, that's sort of interesting, because what can you tell me about water? It's a very important intermediate in all chemical reactions, but it is what? It is also the solvent that our bodies are dissolved in. It's the solvent. Okay, so that's kind of interesting to think of that. Okay. All right, so NADH and FADH2 from Krebs cycle carry electrons to electron transport chain, and those electrons are just settled via sequence of oxidation reduction reactions to produce ATP. Because as the electrons move down over here, that's exothermic, and that drives these endothermic reactions. 3 times for NADH and 2 times for FADH2. Okay. All right, so the production of ATP via the electron transport chain, right, is dependent on oxygen right here. We call this oxidative phosphorylation. So oxidative phosphorylation is the process of making ATP via the electron transport chain. Right? And so the energy of these electrons is used to phosphorylate ATP to make ADP. But we saw that ATP is also made by other metabolic pathways that are not the electron transport chain. Where else is ATP made inside the cell? Okay, in the cytosol, with what kind of reaction? Yeah, or metabolic pathway, glycolysis. All right, so ATP can be made by glycolysis just by using some enzymes. We don't call that oxidative phosphorylation. We call that substrate level phosphorylation. All right, so in glycolysis, this is substrate level phosphorylation. Okay, in the electron transport chain, this is called what? Oxidative phosphorylation. Now, there were some other places that made ATP. Where was another place that made ATP besides electron transport and glycolysis? The Krebs cycle. What level of phosphorylation is that? Where is that? Ah, right here. Where's my arrow? Right here. This ATP. What kind of process is making that ATP? Is it oxidative phosphorylation or substrate level phosphorylation? Okay. Only electron transport chain can make ATP by oxidative phosphorylation. Every other process is substrate level. So the Krebs cycle makes ATP by substrate level phosphorylation. Going to have to go back and take a look at that because we haven't talked about ETC yet, but I think that's maybe the next slide. All right, so here is the next slide, because you might be wondering, how is it that using this flow of electrons through the cytochromes and coenzyme Q, how is that able to make ATP? How are these set of exergonic reactions coupled to this endergonic reaction right here? And people didn't know for many, many, many years, and a lot of people got some Nobel Prizes for figuring this out. And so now we know, and it's called the chemiosmotic theory. Chemiosmotic theory. So when you see theory, what does that mean to you? It's proven by all kinds of different experiments and different laboratories, and it's a generally accepted way that things work. All right, so energy gathered by electron transport chain is used to pump hydrogen ions into the mitochondrial outer chamber. So remember, the mitochondria has an outer membrane, and it also has an inner membrane. What do we call this inner membrane right here? That's the Christie membrane, right? The Christie membrane. And so here's a space between them. So this is what we call the intermembrane space. And this space inside the Christie membrane is what we call the matrix right here. So this is the matrix, and here's the intermembrane space. And this is a nice phospholipid bilayer. So what can move across this Christie membrane? Only hydrophobic molecules, but charged molecules and hydrophilic molecules cannot, just like the outer membrane right here. All right, so NADH from the cytoplasm, all right, can enter the mitochondria, and it can enter the matrix right here, but it takes some energy to do that. They can't just move across. So the NADHs that are made by glycolysis, right, when they move into the inner mitochondrial membrane to donate those electrons to the electron transport chain, they lose some energy and they get converted into FADH2. All right, as a matter of fact, two of them. All right, but when you're thinking about NADH, how many ATPs can be made with NADH? Okay, three. How many ATPs can be made by FADH2? That's right, it can only make two. So that's why the NADHs made by glycolysis are not really the same NADHs made by the Krebs cycle here or the preparatory reaction. Because in order to donate those electrons to electron transport chain, some energy has to be lost. And for how much energy is lost for every NADH in the cytosol? It is, for every NADH, it is what? One ATP that's lost, right? Three ATP versus two. All right, so we'll have to pay attention to that when we try to add things up. Okay, so here we see an NADH, and it's loaded with high-energy electrons, right? And so it donates it to FMN. That's not labeled on this slide right here. And as these electrons move from FMN to the other carriers of electrons, this is a transmembrane protein. And it can use the energy of these electrons flowing through it to actually pump hydrogen ions from the matrix into the intermembrane space. All right, so what's a pump again? What does a pump do for us? Is it active or passive? It's active. It can move things from a low concentration to a high concentration. All right, so what's the pH of this intermembrane space? It is very acidic. It's very acidic. So what kind of pH is that? That is actually a low pH. Okay, as these electrons flow through this electron transport chain, all right, that energy is used to pump protons from a low concentration in the matrix to a high concentration in this intermembrane space. All right, and so then these electrons find another carrier, which is a pump, and it pumps more protons into this intermembrane space. All right, and then there's a third pump that those electrons flow through that can also pump protons into this intermembrane space right here. All right, so as a result of electrons flowing through electron transport chain, what has developed across the Christie membrane? There is a huge gradient of protons, high in the intermembrane space, low in the matrix. So what's the natural tendency of these protons? What do they want to do? They want to run down their concentration gradient and get back in the matrix, but of course they can't get through the membrane right here. All right. So what else did you know about a gradient of something? What it really is, a gradient of sodium ions or a gradient of charge? What is it really? A gradient is really energy, right? It's a form of energy. And remember, energy can either be created or destroyed. And as the energy of these electrons is lost, where does that energy go? It goes into the energy of this proton gradient across the Christie membrane. And then here we have a fourth protein that goes across the Christie membrane. And this is a special kind of proton channel. And we call this ATP synthase. So this particular protein right here will allow for the diffusion of protons to go from high concentration to low back into the matrix, all right? But it also can tap into that energy that's stored in that concentration gradient. And this protein right here is very special because it can take ADP, inorganic phosphate, and make an ATP out of it using the energy gradient in the protons across this membrane right here. So this is what we call the chemiosmotic theory. Chemiosmotic theory says that the proton gradient is used to make ATP via what kind of membrane protein right here? What membrane protein is that? That is the ATP synthase, or you could call it an ATP synthetase. All right, so that's how this exothermic reaction of electrons flowing through the electron transport chain can be used to drive this endothermic reaction, right, by just looking at these different membrane proteins. All right, so what happens when there's no longer a hydrogen ion concentration gradient across this membrane? What happens? Then ATP synthase can't work. It stops working. It stops making ATP. All right, so that gradient has to be there. Okay. Now, where do these electrons end up again? Don't forget, they're accepted by oxygen. And oxygen, with the incorporation of some hydrogens, produces water. So that's the function of oxygen, and that's what keeps the mitochondria functioning and making ATP for us. All right, so let's see what we can work on our table here on the board. Let me erase this right here. Okay, so electron transport, does the electron transport make any NADHs or FADH2s? No, it doesn't. It just accepts electrons from those things. Okay, under aerobic conditions. All right, so glycolysis, is this a nice, let me see how to write this on the board. Okay, how about ATPs that are produced? ATPs that are produced. Well, with glycolysis, all right, we got two ATPs. Glycolysis also makes what? These two NADHs, but they're in the cytosol. In order for the NADH to make ATP, where does it have to go? It's got to go through electron transport, which is in the mitochondria. NADH can't get in the mitochondria, but it gets converted into FADH2. Right, when it enters the mitochondria. So via this glycolytic pathway, how many ATPs then can be produced? Okay, so 2 times 2 would be 4. 4 ATP. Okay, but don't forget, under anaerobic conditions, this NADH can't go anywhere, so only 2 under anaerobic conditions. So we're going to look for, try to come up with a tally for aerobic respiration. All right, the preparatory reaction. Then this is for every glucose. Makes 2 NADHs. How many ATP does that turn into? Okay, for NADH, it's 3 times 2 is 6. Okay, the Krebs cycle. Is this Krebs cycle right here? Looks good. These NADHs can make 3 each, right? And can make 2 each right over here for the FADH2s. So since those are in the mitochondria already, 3 times 6 is 18 ATP. So this is ATP formation. The FADs can make 2 each. 2 times 2 is 4. Okay, and then the Krebs cycle just makes 2 ATP on top of that. All right, so what does this give us for aerobic respiration? What do we got? We got 36. All right, so there's 10, 28, all right, 36. 36 ATP for ATP / aerobic respiration. That's for aerobic respiration. 36 ATP. Kind of a theoretical maximal amount. Under real world conditions, it's going to be a little bit less than that. And depending on the tissue, it might be more or less than that. So the generally accepted range might be anywhere between 30 and 38 ATP for what kind of molecule? Yeah, for what kind of molecule do we put into the system to generate ATP? At the very beginning, what molecule did we start with way back when? Glucose, yeah, per every glucose molecule. Right, for every glucose molecule. Okay, so that's what I want you to know. You have a little, you have another table that says something a little bit differently. Okay, this one right here. All right, it says what? The theoretical estimates of ATP production from oxidative phosphorylation are 2 ATP for every FADH2. And 3 for every NADH, and that's what I would like for you to know. But under real-world circumstances, the FAD might produce something less, maybe 1.5, or maybe 1.75, or 1.42, right, or something like that. And people are going to be discussing that number. If you're a scientist, you're very interested in that number. But if you're just trying to get some basic understanding of respiration, what should you say? 2 for FADH, and 3 for every NADH, okay? Okay, and then you just have to remember which ones are produced by the Krebs cycle, preparatory reaction, or glycolysis, yeah?
That 2 inhibitor, that's made from the ATP.
This right here? Here. Yeah, from Krebs cycle. All right, so what is happening here? You got what? The GTP, two GTP, which go into make two ATP.
And like a C5 like I thought it said oxidative phosphorylation in the Krebs cycle, but you said the Krebs cycle is what? Direct substrate. Okay.
Well, there's one. This one right here, when GTP is made, that's substrate level phosphorylation. The only metabolic pathway that can make ATP oxidatively is electron transport right here. Okay, so that's some common feature with the Krebs cycle and glycolysis. It makes ATP via substrate level phosphorylation. Only oxidative phosphorylation happens in the electron transport chain. For every one NADH. And there are two that are made for every FADH2.
But how much ATP is produced in
electrolytes? Oh, in total? For every glucose. Well, let's take a look. Electron transport is going to get electrons from these electrons that come from glycolysis, okay, and it's going to get these, and it's going to get these, and it's going to get these right over here, okay. So how many ATP can be made with this one right here? Okay, 2 times 2 is 4, and here 2 times 3 is 6, and then, okay, 3 times 6 is 18. Okay, then 2 times 2, here's another 4. So, what's that? 28, that's 22. Is that 22? So, electron transport via oxidative phosphorylation can make 22 ATPs. It needs a Krebs cycle to do that. Yeah.
Can you go back to the drawing along the membrane of the left
line? Here. Okay, so don't forget. Yeah, let me just say one last thing, and then I'll be happy to answer your question. Don't forget, there is energy in this proton gradient that can be used by ATP synthase to oxidatively, right, join inorganic phosphate and ADP to make ATP. Yeah.
Was it
28 makes more sense. 32. Okay, here. 32. Okay. So there aren't a lot of extra ATPs that are, 32. There aren't a lot of extra ATPs made via what? Substrate level phosphorylation. All of these ATPs that are made by NADH and FADH2 are made by what kind of process? Oxidative phosphorylation. All the other ATPs that are made just by enzymatic reactions are made by substrate level phosphorylation. Okay, so this right here is an exam figure. Okay.
Dr. Gober?
Yeah.
So, just trying to understand, so during oxidative phosphorylation, it drives the H ion into the intermembrane phase?
The pumps do?
Yeah.
Yep. As electrons are flowing through the electron transport chain, these hydrogens that are at low concentration in the matrix get pumped up into the intermembrane space. All right, and we see that there are three pumps right here. And FADH2 is going to donate electrons after this first pump. That's why it can't produce as many ATPs. The chemiosmosis refers to What? Well, it refers to this proton gradient across the Christi membrane, and that gradient in protons can be used as an energy source to make ATP. So don't forget, energy can either be created or destroyed, and as these electrons give up energy, that energy can be used to make a gradient. Right, so that energy is still around in terms of the gradient, and then as the gradient goes away, this protein right here, namely ATP synthase, can use that energy to drive an endothermic reaction, namely the synthesis of ATP. That's the chemiosmotic theory. Okay, let's look a little bit at some fat and protein metabolism. But before we get there, so we looked at a lot of different mechanisms. Okay, right here. Cellular respiration. This shows cellular respiration, namely the two parts, anaerobic versus aerobic respiration. What's the whole point of cellular respiration? Is to produce ATP. That's right. And so now you know that there are two major pathways for producing ATP, and they can be thought of as being anaerobic versus aerobic. All right. Another way of thinking about them is by oxidative phosphorylation versus what kind of phosphorylation? Substrate level phosphorylation. Okay. And the only metabolic pathway that can produce ATP via oxidative phosphorylation is where? Electron transport chain. What kinds of metabolism can produce ATP directly, just through enzymatic reactions? So that's called substrate level phosphorylation. Where does substrate level phosphorylation take place? Glycolysis, and also one from the Krebs cycle. Okay, but most of these reactions, okay, the Krebs cycle, are what? Gathering high energy electrons so that the electron transport chain can make many, many ATP. And that's why we say the job of the mitochondria is to make ATP for our bodies, right? Because that's where the electron transport chain is, inside mitochondria. And of course, we need oxygen in order for that to happen. All right, so the overall purpose of respiration is to make ATP. So which respiration is much more efficient, anaerobic respiration or aerobic respiration? Yeah, aerobic respiration. Kind of a nice way of thinking of that is, say, maybe you need to buy some gasoline on the way home tonight, right, because your gas tank is almost on empty. And you got a couple of different gas stations. You got gas station A and you got gas station B. And let's just say at both of these gas stations, gas costs $5 per gallon, no matter what gas station you go to. All right. Hopefully we won't see that again anytime soon. All right. But you know that if you go to gas station A, you can get 30 miles per gallon. But at gas station B, you can only get 2 miles per gallon. All right, so what gas station are you going to go to?
A.
Yeah, definitely go to A, right? Because you get a lot more energy for the same cost. All right, so if you were going to design somebody, would you design them to operate under anaerobic respiration or aerobic respiration? Aerobic respiration is much more efficient, right? Okay, but what organelle do you have to have in order to have aerobic respiration? Mitochondria, and there are many organisms that don't. Anybody know an organism that doesn't have a mitochondria? It's a little primitive, like bacteria don't, for instance, right? Okay, so they're at a pretty significant disadvantage. Okay, fats and proteins. I just want to touch on this just a little bit. Okay, fats can be hydrolyzed into their building blocks. What are the building blocks of triglycerides? glycerol and three fatty acids. And can you remember what a fatty acid looks like? It's a long hydrocarbon chain with a lot of carbon-carbon bonds in it. Those are pretty high-energy bonds. And fatty acids can be modified to run through the Krebs cycle. And how does an organic molecule enter the Krebs cycle to produce energy? Yeah, acetyl-CoA. And what is that acetyl group? It's a two-carbon fragment, right? It has two carbons. So fatty acids are broken down into two carbon fragments, and those two carbon pieces then enter the Krebs cycle. And then that can generate, what, NADHs and FADH2s and even an ATP to make ATP for us. So there's a lot of energy in fatty acids because fatty acids could be as long as 18 carbon atoms long. They're very, very long. So for every 18 carbon fatty acid, that means the Krebs cycle can work, can turn, what, 9 times. How many times does it turn for one glucose? Only 2 times, right? So that's why there's even more energy in fatty acids than glucose. Proteins can be broken down into their building blocks, which are amino acids. And there is one functional group on an amino acid that prevents it from operating or being donated to the Krebs cycle. Right, and that is a nitrogen group, right? It's got an amino group. That amino group has to be taken off an amino acid before it can be donated to the Krebs cycle, and we call that a deamination. All right, so these pathways can be used to interconvert carbohydrates, fats, and proteins. All right, so what do we have right here? This is a nice overview of what do you call glucose going to pyruvic acid again, that is glycolysis. Pyruvic acid going into acetyl-CoA, what is that called? What reaction is that? That's the preparatory reaction, right, inside of a mitochondria someplace. All right, but what else is happening right here going from pyruvic acid to acetyl-CoA in terms of the number of carbons in these two different molecules? Yeah, there's a decarboxylation in that preparatory reaction. So pyruvic acid has 3 carbons. Acetyl-CoA only has 2. So there's a decarboxylation reaction right here. All right, notice that between pyruvic acid and 3-phosphoglyceraldehyde right here, how many arrows do you see? You see 2 arrows, right? So glycolysis can work in the reverse direction. But what about this reaction between pyruvic acid and acetyl-CoA? How many arrows do you see? There's only 1 arrow, so it can only operate in one direction. Once something has been converted into acetyl-CoA, it can never be converted back to what? It can be converted back to glucose. And what would we call that process? That would be gluconeogenesis, right? So gluconeogenesis cannot happen with acetyl-coenzyme A because it's just a 2-carbon fragment. In order for gluconeogenesis to take place, how many carbon fragment molecule do you need? You need a 3-carbon. You can't just use a 2-carbon. All right, so here we have fat, or for instance, a triglyceride. It can be broken down to glycerol and fatty acids. The glycerol is nice because it is, how many carbons are in glycerol? 3. Because it's a 3-carbon molecule, it can be used for gluconeogenesis. All right, but fatty acids can't because the way they are metabolized, they're broken down into just 2-carbon fragments. And we're going to learn the name of this pathway in just a second. All right, so then acetyl-CoA is donated to the Krebs cycle, and that can generate a lot of ATP. So if there are 18 carbons in a fatty acid, this Krebs cycle can turn, 9 times to generate a lot of ATP. Okay. All right, so here we have fatty acids. Can a fatty acid ever be used to make glucose? Can it be used to make glucose? What's the fate of this fatty acid right here? All right, and if you have, for instance, fatty acids in your diet, what can your body do with these fatty acids? It can be used to make fat or triglycerides, or these fatty acids can be used to make acetyl-CoA, which generates what kind of molecule in your body? What's the whole reason for this Krebs cycle right here is to make ATP. So fatty acids can be used to make fat in your body or energy, ATP, and that's it. Okay, because fatty acids, because they're broken down into two carbon fragments, cannot participate in gluconeogenesis. All right, so what's the fate of this fatty acid right here? It's for to make ATP or to make fat. And another way of saying that, fatty acids cannot be used to make sugars. You can't make a sugar out of a fatty acid. And what's another organic compound? What are the four basic organic compounds in your body? You got carbohydrates, proteins, all right, lipids, and nucleic acids. So fatty acids can only be used to make energy or to make fats. If they can't be used to make carbohydrates, can't be used to make proteins, and can't be used to make nucleic acids. It can only be used for energy. And that's why, because acetyl-CoA is a two-carbon fragment, right? Okay. What's another two-carbon fragment that we looked at? I think we looked at in here. All right. Our bodies use can get rid of pyruvate via, what, the lactate dehydrogenase pathway. But other organisms, all right, can take lactate, pyruvate. Yeah, can make pyruvate, decarboxylate it, all right, produce CO2. All right, so that's one carbon. How many carbon fragment is left over? There's just a two-carbon fragment left over. What's that called? Yeah, ethyl alcohol or ethanol. All right, and what do we use ethanol for recreationally? Well, just to get intoxicated, all right? So that's a two-carbon fragment. Now, how is that utilized in your body? What can you do with ethyl alcohol? I'll draw it right here. So here is ethyl alcohol, and of course these lines right here just represent hydrogen atoms. What can your body do with ethyl alcohol after you drink it? What is ethyl alcohol like in your body? What's the fate of ethyl alcohol? Okay, yeah, it's toxic. But think in terms of the number of carbon atoms that are in ethyl alcohol. There are two, and where do you see a two carbon molecule on this chart right here? Yeah, acetyl-CoA, right? So ethyl alcohol can be converted into acetate, and it can enter your metabolism right here, right, at acetyl-CoA. So what are the fates of acetyl-CoA again? Can it be used to make glucose via gluconeogenesis? Cannot. Can acetyl-CoA be used to make fatty acids? Yes, it can, okay, because you see this arrow right here. Or, right, acetyl-CoA can be used for energy metabolism to make ATP. So when you drink ethyl alcohol, what is it like? It's just like eating fat. It's just like eating lipid, because that's the only thing that your body can use that ethyl alcohol for. And why is that? Because it's just a two-carbon fragment. Ethanol can't be used to run gluconeogenesis. So whenever you have a drink or a beer or something like that, it's like eating what? It's like eating a bar of butter. And people really hate taking this class when they learn that. Okay? Okay. Okay, because that's a two-carbon fragment. Okay. Okay. So lipogenesis is the synthesis of fats. You need fatty acids and glycerol. Using a dehydration synthesis reaction, and you end up with a triglyceride. There is an amazing amount of energy in every gram of fat. There's 9 kilocalories, right? And for carbohydrates and proteins, there's only 4 kilocalories per gram. So for every gram, what kind of organic material has a lot more energy in it? Fats, right? It has more than twice the amount of energy, right? So, and fat is stored in an anhydrous form, which means you don't have to store it with water. So it's a very efficient way of storing energy in our body. Okay. Okay, lipolysis, the breaking down of lipids. All right, so you break triglycerides down into fatty acids and glycerol. via hydrolysis reaction. The enzyme is lipase. And the way it's broken down is by two carbon fragments at a time. And that produces the acetyl-CoAs, which then can be used by the Krebs cycle right here. All right, so this is the overall reaction. So a fatty acid, what's the terminal functional group of a fatty acid? It's a carboxyl group, right? And from the preparatory reaction and the Krebs cycle, what can your body do with carboxyl groups? It can undergo a decarboxylation. All right, so this process right here is what we call beta oxidation. Beta oxidation will chop off, instead of CO2s, it's going to chop off this acetyl group right here. All right, and in so doing, produce a number of ATPs, as well as FADH2s and NADH2s. All right, so that happens for every two carbon group on a fatty acid. So this can happen 9 times, for instance, for an 18 carbon fatty acid. All right, so this produces ATP and NADH, plus the acetyl-CoAs then get donated to the Krebs cycle, and that produces what? Even more ATPs as a result of that. All right, so beta oxidation produces a tremendous amount of ATPs when we break fatty acids down into these acetyl groups. And so basically that's all I want you to know about how lipids are degraded in your body. Okay, so you should know where this takes place. And I don't know if it says on this slide right here. So this reaction right here takes place in mitochondria. And it can happen only under aerobic conditions. And we call it beta oxidation. All right, so the question on a test might be, what metabolic pathway is used to break fatty acids down into energy? And you're going to say beta oxidation. And where does it occur? In the mitochondria. And what molecule does beta oxidation produce? It is acetyl-CoA, and acetyl-CoA can only be used at this point right here is to make what? ATP. Can't be used to make carbohydrates or proteins or anything like that. Okay. Oh, so that's it. That's all I want you to know about beta oxidation. Like, where does it take place? What kind of molecule it produces? Okay. All right. So who's got a question? Anybody have a question? Electron transport. Anybody have a question about electron transport chain? Yes. Electron transport, does it use ATP? No. Electron transport, let's go back to this one. Electron transport, all right, electron transport, which is right here, okay. Electrons go from high energy to low energy when they flow from one cytochrome to another. But as they move, it takes ADP and inorganic phosphate and makes an ATP out of it. So electron transport doesn't use ATP. It actually does what? It makes ATP. Okay? So electron transport makes ATP. So that is, and how does it make ATP? How does electron transport make ATP? Yeah, using the concentration gradient of protons across the Christi membrane. This is true. That's a nice operational understanding of it. But there's another way you could think about it too, a little bit more succinctly. It makes ATP via oxidative phosphorylation. Yeah.
What is it considered oxidative phosphorylation? Because like, isn't chemia osmosis used that ATP synthase, and that's what produces the ATP?
Yeah, but in order to get those, in order to get ATP synthase working, let's see if I can get that on the slide. In order to get ATP synthase working, which is this right here, what do you have to have? You have to have an energy source in order for ATP synthetase or synthase to work. You need an energy source. What is that energy source? Okay, the most direct energy source. What is interacting with this ATP synthase in order to get it to work? There has to be a flow of protons through it. Right? There has to be a flow of protons from high concentration in the intermembrane space into the matrix. That's the most direct energy source. But where does that, where does the energy come from to make the proton gradient? The flow of electrons through the cytochromes, and the electrons can only flow through the cytochromes if what is present? This oxygen right here. Without oxygen, these electrons can't flow, and then these membrane proteins here won't pump the protons, and if there's no proton gradient, then ATP synthase can't do its job. All right, and so because all of this depends on oxygen being present, we call that oxidative phosphorylation. So the presence of oxygen right here acts like a switch that can turn this whole process on and off. It just acts like a switch, just like you have a switch on the wall, right? A switch on the wall will stop the flow of electrons through an electrical appliance, like a light bulb or something. And so this is acting like a switch. You could think of the cytochrome system as being like an electrical circuit even, okay? Using the energy and the flow of electrons to make ATP. Okay. There's one last thing I want to say about this that probably might become important clinically, maybe in our lifetime. And so we see what organelle is mostly responsible for producing ATP in our bodies? Mitochondria. That's right. And of course, you need oxygen in order for mitochondria to do their job. And if we were to turn off oxygen to our brain, how long would our brain be able to maintain consciousness? I think we talked about that, right? About 3 seconds, okay? And then after what period of time does the brain actually die? 3 minutes. That's a really short period of time, okay? All right, so the mitochondria are doing their job as long as they have oxygen here. But recently, scientists have discovered something kind of interesting, but actually kind of horrific. What happens to this system right here when a mitochondria does not have oxygen? Okay, so follow this discussion. When a mitochondria doesn't have oxygen, it still, nonetheless, likes to maintain this gradient of hydrogen ions across the Christi membrane. But if there's no oxygen here, the mitochondria can't use this flow of electrons to put protons into the intermembrane space, to pump protons up there. All right, so in lieu of that, what's another energy source that a mitochondria has available to it for putting protons up in this area right up over here in the intermembrane space? What is still available to a mitochondria is this ATP synthetase. And what happens is, under low oxygen concentrations, this ATP synthetase actually goes in the reverse direction. So it's going to start pumping protons into this intermembrane space because that's what a mitochondria really loves to do. But where does the mitochondria then get energy to put high energy or to make this concentration gradient of protons? It gets it from, what's this right here? Yeah, it utilizes ATP that it has in the matrix to run the ATP synthase in the reverse direction because it likes to have high, this to be an acidic environment right here. So what does that do to the cell? That really shortens the life of the cell because now the mitochondria, instead of providing ATP under anaerobic conditions, it is doing what? It is actually using up ATP. So wouldn't it be really cool to find out some kind of pharmaceutical agent that under stressful conditions where you don't have oxygen, we could actually poison this ATP synthase so that the mitochondria don't burn up all the ATP that your cells need to stay alive. Okay, so that might be something that you guys have to realize at some point in time. Why, under what conditions, maybe a heart attack or a stroke or something, we would actually like to be able to turn off this part of the mitochondria so that it doesn't use up ATP and that's going to be protective to the organs as a result of that. Yeah. Right here? Okay, the blue had to do with the amount of ATP that is produced by electron transport chain in particular. So ATP, okay. So I don't know. So let me just talk a little bit about that. So the ATP that's made by electron transport could also be described as what kind of process? Oxidative phosphorylation. All right. So where is, what's the molecule that inputs energy into the electron transport chain? Is it acetyl group or pyruvate or glucose, or what kind of molecule is necessary for electron transport to work? It's only NADH, right, or FADH2. That's the only thing the electron transport chain is interested in, because it needs high energy electrons. And that's where it gets high energy electrons from. So I looked at glycolysis, the preparatory reaction, and the Krebs cycle to see where and how many of those electron carriers are produced. All right, so for glycolysis, don't forget, it makes two NADHs, but it is where? It's not in the mitochondria, it's in the cytosol. So it's, that has, you have to lose some energy to get these electrons into the mitochondria, and the energy ends up in FADH2. These electrons at a lower free energy than these electrons in NADH. Okay? So these electrons are going to go through electron transport and produce oxidative phosphorylation. All right, what about this energy right here? This energy, that's ATP already. It doesn't have anything to do with electron transport chain. All right. The preparatory reaction. Remember, that's a decarboxylation, but it's also oxidation-reduction reaction that produces two NADHs. And this dotted line right here represents the mitochondrial membrane. So this NADH stays NADH, doesn't have to be converted into FADH2 to get inside the mitochondria. And how many, for this class, how many ATP are produced for every NADH? It's going to be 3. All right. Realistically, that might not happen in all cells, but that's just a complication, all right, that I don't want you guys to think about. So just say 3. So 2 times 3 is 6. All right. The Krebs cycle produces, for every turn of the Krebs cycle, it produces 3 NADHs, but for every glucose, it turns twice. So that's why we got 6 over here. It's inside the mitochondria. So how many ATP? It is 3 times 6, that's 18. And then also for the Krebs cycle, don't forget there's another step there that makes FADH2s. And that happens twice for every glucose. You get 2 rounds of the Krebs cycle. So, and for FADH2, you can make 2 ATP at a maximum. So 2 times 2 is 4. All right, so here are all of the high energy molecules that can be used by oxidative phosphorylation to make ATP. So how did I do this? 6 and 4 is 10, plus 18 is 28, plus another 4 is 32. Okay, so 32 ATPs are made by oxidative phosphorylation, but you got to know where that happens. That happens in the mitochondria, and under what kind of conditions? Only aerobic conditions, right? Only when oxygen is present. Right, and the remaining ATP, the other 4 ATPs, are made by what kind of process? Substrate level phosphorylation. Right, so the other 4 are made where? 2 by glycolysis, and then 2 because of the 2 rounds of the Krebs cycle that make these 2 GTPs, which can be converted very quickly into ATP. Okay, so here's 2 and 2 ATPs here. That's where those extra 4 come from.
So we say 32, 38.
Okay. If I give you a question on the test, aerobic versus anaerobic respiration, it's, in my way of thinking, very easy, because anaerobic respiration is going to be 2 ATP, and for oxidative phosphorylation, if everything goes all the way through, it's going to be what? It's going to be up in the 30s. Okay, and in this class, I don't really care if it's 31 or 32 or 33 or 34. The cell is going to change depending on conditions and the tissue. All right, but what's important for you to know is anaerobic respiration produces 2, aerobic respiration produces what, 30-something. And is that a big enough difference to give you an impression that there's really, yeah, 2 versus 30-something, right, is a really big difference, right? Okay. So that's really all I want you to know about anaerobic versus aerobic. But you got to know where they take place and that kind of thing. Okay. So what does a gradient have? What does a gradient have in it? It is energy. And because of the laws of thermodynamics, that energy can be converted into something else. The chemiosmotic theory just says that that proton gradient can be converted into chemical energy in the form of ATP. Okay? Okay, yeah, another good question. Yeah, how much energy is lost? Well, NADH in the cytosol, okay, well, just say for every NADH you can make 3 ATP. But if it's in the cytosol, it can't enter the mitochondria. It has to be converted into FADH2. How many ATP can be made by FADH2? Only 2. So you lose 1 ATP for every reduced NADH you have in the cytosol. Yeah? Okay. Just to get it in the mitochondria. Yeah. All right, don't forget the sign-in sheet is down over here.